This is the first day of this March 2014 seven-day session, and I'm going to devote this first teisho to chanting, the role of chanting in Zen, and different things about chanting. Because I think for a lot of us in Zen, it takes a long time to come to appreciate the value of chanting. Zen wouldn't be considered the type of spiritual practice known as bhakti yoga. Bhakti meaning devotional. There's a way, I learned this in college, there's a way of classifying different spiritual practices around the world as yoga just meaning work, spiritual work, and bhakti yoga are those kinds that emphasize devotion. So maybe the Pure Land Buddhism is more of a devotional form of Buddhism, where we play the practice, the formula is I place my faith in Amida Buddha. So it's more worshipful. Zen is not. It's something else. And so I think a lot of us who are attracted to Zen have to work our way into the chanting and it's what it can do for our practice. And I hope to help people understand better what it can do for our practice. First of all, it's our tradition. For hundreds and hundreds of years in Zen, not Pure Land, just Pure Land Buddhism, but in Zen Buddhism, chanting has been part of daily practice and monastic training, and now more recently, non-monastic training. This whole aspect of practice, the devotional side, offers a way for us to flesh out the practice of Zen, which let's admit it is a pretty spare and even can be severe type of practice, so that to flesh out the practice so it will appeal to all of us, the emotions as well as reason, our heart as well as the head. Chanting allows us to exercise the heart, because it has this devotional side to it. In that sense, it complements the many hours of just wall gazing that we do. It complements the sitting as well by being more active. Chanting, as most of you have heard many, many times, chanting is another form of practice. It's not, strictly speaking, it's not zazen, sitting zen, even though we are in sitting when we do it usually. But it is more of a form of active practice. Of course, we're always trying to extend the mind of Zen meditation into everything we do. So in terms of our daily activities, that means whatever we're doing, to do it with this stabilized awareness. And with chanting is just another form of a more active Zen practice. What that means is that we want to do it single-mindedly. In order to derive the real benefit of chanting, we have to do it single-mindedly, which means applying ourselves just as we do during when we're facing the wall. How? Apply ourselves how? Well, by noticing when thoughts are intruding and letting them go. Just getting back into the pure act of chanting. In other words, we want to be able eventually to reach a kind of chanting samadhi. Samadhi just means the fusion or the merging of subject and object. When we're facing the wall, we're fusing the subject with the practice, the particular practice of working on breath, koan, shikantaza. We want to reach state of oneness where there is no self apart. Everyone knows this. That's, by the time you get to Sesshin, you know all this. But what people may not fully grasp is how important it is in chanting to do the same thing. So for people whose practice, when they're facing the wall, is breath practice, you don't try to follow your breath or count your breath during chanting, of course, but you simply want to become fully one with the chanting, just as when we're brushing our teeth. If your practice is breath practice, then when you're brushing your teeth, it's to become fully one with the brushing of the teeth, which means noticing when the mind is wandering and bringing it back. That's what chanting calls for, is noticing when the mind wanders. And it can so easily wander because we're not sitting absolutely still. We may be holding up a chant book. We're certainly moving the mouth, jaw. So there's a little bit more, the body's a little more activated during chanting. And we can easily find ourselves with the mind going astray. So most easily reach this chanting samadhi? Well, there are a whole bunch of things that most of you have heard in our guidelines, our advice about chanting. First is to sit still, as still as you can, while possibly still needing to use a chant book or, as we said this morning, if you can sit in a kneeling position, what in Japan is called the seiza position, if you can sit in a kneeling position without discomfort, this opens up the hara more. So our chanting flows better. It can be more likely be stronger if you're sitting in a kneeling position, straddling a cushion or a bench. If you can't, if you have a problem with sitting in the kneeling position, okay, then cross-legged is all right. Want to have the eyes down. I think a lot of people, at least earlier in their practice, they want to drift off the reservation during chanting and check out people around them. And this will interfere with your experiencing the full potential of chanting, because it will agitate the mind a little bit when you're looking around. So it really helps during a chanting service to keep the eyes down. Don't be concerned about anyone around you. It's the same as facing the wall. You're going to stand a much better chance of reaching this deeper absorption if you're not taking in sights. Back straight, of course. That's how we're designed. That's why we sit in Zazen facing the wall with a back straight, because that's how we are designed to sit upright with the back straight. When we're just old enough to sit upright, say 6 months or 6 month old baby, is we don't have to be told to sit straight, because that's how our anatomy works. You see a six-month-old child, set it on a table or a bed or something, and she or he will sit with a beautifully straight back. So that just goes without saying. Straight back during Zazen, straight back during chanting, straight back when we're walking. That's our natural alignment. And when we're sitting or standing or walking with a straight back, then our energies will flow, will function more smoothly, with greater energy. And with the back straight, if we're using a book, we want to hold the book up. Because if you have the book down near your lap, then you have to dip the head down to read it. And when you dip the head down, then you break that line running up the spine up to the top of the head. So if you're using a book, hold it up. Hold it up to at least your chest height. When your head is tipped down, then we lose that all-important alignment. That's why during Zazen too, we want to keep the head straight, neither with the chin neither down nor up. And while I'm at it, I'll just mention when the chin is up a little during Zazen, it just sucks thoughts into the mind. And when it's tipped down, it also is not the best way to sit. Want to chant with some volume. Don't be shy. Unless you're just starting to try to go solo without the chant book, then you want to dial it down a bit until you feel that you've gotten it clear. And there's always that transition when we're on the way to memorizing a chant. Then we're going to be a little shaky at first, and in that case, you don't want to be chanting too loudly and throw other people off with your mistakes. But otherwise, if you're reading the book or you know it cold, then by all means, put out some volume. And there too, the middle way, not to drown out people next to you, nor to be drowned out by them, but find that middle way where you're contributing to the chanting. You're not just murmuring, moving your lips, but you're really giving. Chanting is like Zazen in that respect. It's an act of dana. You're expending energy. You're applying yourself. You want to harmonize with the dominant pitch. Most people find a way to do this. There are certain people who have a rough time with this. They're challenged in terms of finding the right pitch. Outside Sesshin, we work with those people and we make some progress helping them find the right pitch. I found that when I'm most deeply absorbed in chanting, which is late in Sesshin, that I don't want to breathe too, I don't want to inhale too often. And so I always recommend to people that you just go as long as you can, whether that's one line or two lines or three lines, and don't think you have to just inhale at the end of a line, but just drop out in the middle of the line if you're running out of breath, and inhale, and don't rush your inhalation. Don't try to get in without, you know, missing a single syllable. It's okay to miss a few syllables. If the breathing in a more composed way will help you keep the mind more composed. It's one of these things that I came to sort of backwards. It's no one ever told me this, but I just found that when I was really in a most quiet state, that I just wanted to take my time inhaling, and rather than trying to squeeze it in between two lines. And now the style of chanting. In Zen, we chant in a monotone. This reflects the practice in that we're not doing this to stir up our emotions. Feelings and emotions are not the ground of the mind. Some people who are very emotional will think that this is as deep as you can go, is to get into your emotional or feeling state. Well, you can go further than that, which is beyond emotions and feelings. And in Zen chanting, at least in Japanese style Zen chanting, which is what we do, there are other styles. Chinese chanting is quite different. But in our style of chanting, you maintain this sort of monotone without emphasizing the consonants too much. So rather than the Bodhisattva of compassion from the... That's more like what you want to do on the radio. But chanting, it's more the spirit of it. It's the tone or the feeling of it. So you just soften it a little bit without ignoring the consonants. Every once in a while, I hear someone who really goes off the reservation and will... That's too blurred up. So something in between. The Bodhisattva of compassion from the depths of prajna wisdom saw the emptiness of all five skandhas and thundered them on the... So it's the vowels. The emphasis is on the vowels, on the sound, and not so much the words. Because in chanting, we're not trying to focus on the words. This is one of the radical things about Zen chanting. We're not trying to memorize. We're not trying to go for the meaning of the words, and try to listen to the word, the meaning of the words. to be in a chanting samadhi means that it's more, if you think of chanting as a kind of a stream, then you have this dominant current, the bodhisattva-gambhajanram, and the words just sort of poke up from the surface just here and there, but it's primarily that tone. Now, to avoid being attached to the words that we're chanting, it does help to have memorized them. And this can take a long time. I think for the longer chants, like the affirming faith in mind, and especially the Dai Shin, the long Dharani, this can take a very long time. But it's an investment that's worth it if you can find a way to memorize these chants, because if you're reading a book while you're chanting, I'm convinced that you can't reach the deepest state of absorption through the chanting. You're less likely to be able to reach a chanting samadhi if you're reading the words. There's something about that activates, keeps the mind just a little bit active, a little more thought activity when you're reading from the book. So by all means, read from the book if you need to, and that may be years, especially if you're not in training at the center and you're chanting every day. It may take a long time, but little by little, people who are really committed to keeping with this practice for a long time would be advised to try to memorize these chants. And then you're able to let go of yourself, let go of the mind, this discriminating mind, a little more easily when you're doing it from memory. We're not trying to learn things from these sutras. It's not a learning. It's not our intention to learn things. If we were studying sutras, then that'd be a different thing. But here it's chanting. It's not studying. And I use the word sutra because that's what most of these different chants, that's what they are. They're sutras. The Prajnaparamita is a sutra, the shortest, by far the shortest version of the great body of Mahaprajnaparamita literature. They go up to like 100,000 lines, the Prajnaparamita. This is just the kernel. And that's one way of understanding the word heart, the Heart Sutra. It's the kernel of the Prajnaparamita literature. But then the Kanongyo is the shortest form of the Kanon Sutra, and so forth. So we're not trying to learn, we're not really paying attention to the meaning of the words, but it's going for the sound. And when we do that, when we allow the higher brain to take a rest during chanting, When we don't rely on that prefrontal cortex that gets involved in the meaning of the words, then the meaning has a way of seeping into us. Who hasn't had the experience of certainly in Sesshin of finding that some old song is cycling through your mind. I've heard this from plenty of people in Doksan, and certainly have had my own experience with this. For me, it was always the songs that in high school I hated the most were the ones that got running in my mind during Sesshin. This, by the way, is just a sign that the mind is opening, and they're just tapping into some old residue, and it's nothing to be concerned about. What you don't want to do is try to stop that song or those songs from running through your mind. Just ignore it. Don't give it the satisfaction. Just keep returning the mind to whatever your practice is, the breath or the koan. And it's like everything else. Eventually, it'll just recede. The song will recede, and it won't be a problem, which is, by the way, the same thing with pain, physical pain. If you're not getting involved with it mentally, then it has a way of just receding and becoming something peripheral to the work you're doing, and then it's not a problem. And same thing with thoughts. Some stubborn kind of thought that keeps obsessive thought. You don't want to fight it. You don't want to try to stop it. Just leave it alone. Go to your practice, and then the thought. Suddenly you notice. A minute later, or 5 minutes, or 3 hours later, you notice, hey, haven't heard that in a while, that thought or that song. So in this state of relaxed openness while we're chanting, these words are reaching, sinking into the deeper levels of the mind, and this is of enormous benefit to our practice. We're getting it in a way through chanting. There's a Kensho account in the Zen Merging of East and West, Roshi's second main book, in which the author of the Kensho account, someone who used to be on staff long, long ago, described waking up in the middle of the night, the night Sesshin ended. So Saturday night, seven-day Sesshins have always ended on Saturday afternoon. So in the middle of the night, the wee hours of Sunday morning, he woke up and the Prajnaparamita was reverberating in his mind. And he just let himself go with it. I can't explain what that means, but he just allowed himself to go deep into the Prajnaparamita, the words, and it led him into an awakening experience. So he didn't consciously try to bring forth the Prajnaparamita in his state where the mind was so empty. Everyone's mind is empty on the Saturday night of Sesshin, that Sesshin ends. In that state of darkness and openness and clarity, the words of the Prajnaparamita came bubbling up and led him beyond this ordinary mind. So imagine if these inane songs that we've heard years or decades ago, if these can get traction in the mind, imagine allowing through repeated chanting, having these great sutras implant themselves deep in the mind. This we can only speculate about how much that can help our practice and deepen our faith by having this these words in the mind. But we don't do it by while chanting, of thinking about the words of the chants. Another way to understand chanting is it's by vocalizing these sutras, the chants, which means vocalizing the truths that they're pointing to. By vocalizing these, we embody them. It's a way of little by little, over tens or hundreds or thousands of chanting services, we are incorporating, allowing these things to become part of the body, the tissue memory, with the benefit getting them in a way that we wouldn't just by studying them. Literally embodying them, because when we're vocalizing them, moving the tongue, the lips, those are engaged, the larynx, the lungs. This is all body. This is why vows also, not just chanting, but vows are best done aloud. Rather than just thinking them. You know, we could all, for example, with the four vows, we could just think the four vows. But when we speak them, then we have a different relationship, a more intimate relationship with them, and they become part of this body realm. Thought I'd run through the chants that we do, but I have to keep it brief, but just to say a few things about these. Well, we begin with the three treasures. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. At least we do this for the afternoon chanting each day during Sesshin. And these three refuges are arguably the preeminent, most important of all, verses that we can take. People who've received the precepts in Jukai ceremonies have heard that these are the three most important of the 16 precepts that we take in Jukai, are these three refuges. Taking refuge in our Buddha nature, taking refuge in the Dharma, the teaching of Buddha nature, the law, and taking refuge in Sangha, everyone in this room and those who are practicing outside this room. And again, by saying it, and saying it as we're doing the prostration, is a way to find a much more meaningful and intimate relationship with these vows. And the prostrations themselves are a big part, traditionally, of the devotional side of Zen, where we're not just thinking about subordinating this ego consciousness to what is much greater than that, but we're physically doing it by lowering the forehead to the floor, raising the hands. We're affirming our Buddha nature. And if that seems like a kind of far-fetched, then you haven't done enough prostrations, because you find eventually that it feels so right. It's so meaningful to lower the head like that, to go down, lower the head, raise the hands up. It has its own intelligence to it, which is what beginners can't really fully appreciate. It's just hope that beginners are not so resistant and attached to their own ideas about prostrations or chanting that you won't give it a try, because if you do it long enough, then the resistance softens, and it comes alive in a whole different way. The Prajnaparamita is the one chant, as far as I know, that is chanted in every Buddhist country, or at least every Mahayana Buddhist country, in the language of that country. In Vietnam, this chant is done in Vietnamese. In Japan, in Japanese. In China, Chinese. Korean. Thai. And so forth. Tibetan. And the kernel of this is near the beginning, where we chant, form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. These may have been the words that drew this guy who woke up with the Prajnaparamita in his mind in the middle of the night. These may have been the turning words for him. And it really sums up the message of the Prajnaparamita. What we now call the 10-verse Kanon Sutra, there are longer versions of this. This is the 10-verse version of it. Is honoring not just this bodhisattva as some being apart from us, but through chanting this to awaken our own compassion, the compassion that we all have potentially within us. Or so we're really calling to the kanon in our own hearts when we do this. There are these two dharanis, the short one, Shosaimyo, Kichijo Dharani, and which is known as the dharani for averting disaster, and then the longer one, the Daihi Shin. Dai means great. It's also known in English as the dharani of the great compassionate one. There is a Japanese Zen master whose name eludes me at the moment, great master, who said, if you just chant the Daihi Shin, Dharani, that's enough. He was aware that it really is another chant that evokes our own inherent compassion. But both, all Dharanis are... What they are basically strings of mantras. Mantras are these usually single word sounds that derive their power from the sound of them. And that's why we haven't attempted to translate the Dharanis into English, because it's the sound of them, not the meaning of them. There are places where you can, I've been told, I don't never particularly care to search for them, but there are places where you can find parts of these dharanis translated into English. But it's not the meaning of them, but the sound of them that gives them their power. Then there are these return of merit where the lead chanter says, faith in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha brings true liberation. We now return the merit of our chanting to... before we get to whom, this idea of merit. Most Zen students seem to be aware of this legendary encounter between Bodhidharma, the founder of Zen, and the Emperor Wu, where the Emperor, clearly proud of what great support he's given to Buddhism, Buddhist monks and nuns, where he says, so what merit have I acquired from supporting these building temples and monasteries, supporting monks and nuns? And he just, of course, was fishing for compliments. He wanted confirmation that he's got a really good karma. And Bodhisattva says, no merit whatsoever. People remember that because it's so famous. But what they don't appreciate is that Bodhidharma is just balancing the emperor's attachment to merit. So this is common teaching practice. If you see where the student is attached, then you sometimes want to emphasize the other side. But there is another side. Bodhidharma is pointing to the emptiness of phenomena, that side of things, the no-thingness of things. But it's just half the truth. The other half is the side of phenomena or form, and that includes merit. According to our whole tradition, the whole Buddhist tradition, including Zen, Zen is a part of Buddhism, we everything we do and say and even think potentially is creating merit or not. So doing good works, doing social service things, working in a soup kitchen, and other things that help other people. This is all, in doing that, we're accumulating merit, especially if we're not thinking about the merit we're accumulating, or doing it to acquire merit. If we're doing it no-mindedly, then we are heaping up merit, which means just another word for karma. Good karma. Merit is good karma. And there's no better way of accumulating merit than through Zen practice, Zazen. Because it's a practice of non-attachment, ultimately. When we're free of thoughts, then we're free of self. This is non-attachment. But chanting is a form, again, form of Zazen, of Zen practice. So in doing the chanting service, every time we do it, we're acquiring merit. But in this return of merit, the Honzon Eko, it's called Eko in Japanese, we are giving back the merit from our chanting that we've acquired, giving it to these four bodhisattvas. Shakyamuni Buddha Manjusri Bodhisattva Avalokita Bodhisattva Bahadra Bodhisattva. These are the four kind of cabinet level bodhisattvas, the most famous ones, the most we hear about, the most in Zen at least. The three of them, first Shakyamuni Buddha. And then Manjusri Bodhisattva is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. We enshrine a Manjusri figure on the altar during Sesshin, right there in front of the Buddha, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. Avalokita Bodhisattva, that's just another of the several names for Kanon. Avalokiteshvara, Avalokita, Kanzeon, Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And then Bahadra Bodhisattva probably is the least known to people here. Bahadra is a more familiar abbreviation of Samanta Bahadra. Samanta Bahadra, or Bahadra, is the Bodhisattva of action. That is applied action in the world of activity. So you could say that when you're working for social causes or anything that is that you at least believe is for the good, the greatest good for the greatest number. This is, you could say, is the functioning, the work of Samanta Bhadra, or Bhadra. So in returning, it says we return the merit, we're sort of using them as our agents, that these women or guys, these bodhisattvas and the Shakyamuni Buddha are better able through their profound enlightenment to use this merit that we're giving back to them. That's the idea behind it. And then when we say altogether, that previous part is just done by the lead chanter. And then altogether we say 10 directions, 3 worlds, all Buddhas, Bodhisattva, Mahasattvas, Mahaprajnaparamita. Here it's just a way of reminding ourselves that in all, everywhere we can possibly imagine, in all directions, all worlds, visible and invisible worlds, there is just this Buddha nature. I certainly could to do more with this, but let's call it a day. And we'll now recite the 4 vows.